Ladies and gentlemen, the following podcast is scheduled for one fall.
Yeah.
All right. I can't remember who kicked it off last time, but it doesn't matter. None of this matters. We'll kick it off here. Hey, everybody. Like, damn it.
Bloops.
Do it again. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Smarten Up, your education in professional wrestling. I am one of your hosts, Stefan Claypool.
And I am the other host, Drew Zalitas.
Yep. And Drew.
Yep. Yep. What? That was good. That was good.
We're getting better at this.
I ruined it. Sorry.
You ruined it, damn it.
Man. Well, we've got quite a show lined up for you.
I hope you wore your business socks, Drew, because
that's right.
Today it's business time.
I was gonna say we're gonna be probably getting a lot of sound clips of Ted DiBiase's entrance theme,
yep.
Shane McMahon's entrance theme, Bobby Roode's previous entrance theme from TNA.
Yep.
I'm running
the
out.
Godfather's entrance theme.
Sure. He was a businessman.
Yeah, of a kind.
Of a kind. Yeah, we're talking about the business of wrestling. It's something that, like, everything is sort of underlined and been under the surface of everything we've done. But, you know, in some ways, the way that it actually functions as a business, we mostly talk about it as a sort of creative form, but there's obviously a business there. And just like everything else we talk about, it has things in common with other entertainment forms, and then it has things that are sort of all its own. And so that's what's going to be on tap for today.
Yeah, it's I think, as you said, we talk about this as an entertainment property, but wrestling as a genre, I think historically you could say has been almost ruthlessly capitalistic. It is a business first and foremost, and understanding kind of the underlying dynamics of what drives that business, where does the money come from, actually manifests itself in the product in some really interesting ways.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, like, just sort of at its roots. I mean, even before it became what we recognize as wrestling, it was about sort of, you know, some of the earliest ones were carnivals and swindling and, like, you know, con men.
step right up.
Marks, right? So, what's more capitalistic, like ruthless capitalism, than sort of con jobs? So, I think that's a great way to sort of set the overall picture.
So I think that there are a few distinct phases and topics for us to talk about here, but I think the one that probably makes most sense to start with is taking the trip in the Wayback Machine back in time to think about the historical perspective of how did this business start to begin with, and you brought it up straight away with the carnival game. But when we start thinking about what that manifests as in wrestling in, let's say, the Golden Age, what does that mean? It means ticket sales, and wrestling is a ticket sale game. What venues do you sell out? How do you put butts in seats?
Exactly. And so, you know, even on the carnival circuits and things, you know, think of the barker, right, shouting out, you know, trying to draw your attention here. You know, you didn't have months of buildup to get people interested in the fight. You have like a few seconds as they walk by. And, you know, you kind of have your earliest narratives there. I mean, they're very simple, but it's, you know, I want you to want to come watch some people fight each other and to pay for it and get you invested in it. So, I mean, at the simplest level, it's like, all right, we're going to have these people fight. Let's get some people to watch it. And like it is at the carnivals and other things like that, it was always in these early, for the most part, in these early days, associated sort of with something else. Like, yeah. There, at least early on, it took a while to get to where you would go to see wrestling. Like, wrestling was just one of many attractions at a fairground mm-hmm. or something like that. And that obviously is still true today. if you go to a state fair or things like that, you'll see wrestling.
You saw wrestling at a tamale festival, if I remember correctly.
I did. It was actually well worked into the tamale festival. It did not seem separate. So yeah, like that's always still there, but that's definitely the earliest forms. Is a sideshow in the sense that it is to the side of all the other things that one could do. And so that's, of course, where you get the sort of spectacle and the over-the-topness and just trying to, like you said, get those butts in the seats. And then, you know, that's where you start growing people's interest in just seeing that for its own. That's where you also get early stars coming out of that, because if someone was super sort of appealing, that could be the person that you're going to bring, and that's going to get people invested. So, you know, you can kind of tell how it grows out of that.
And it's, I think that point on stars is a good moment to take the second side of this into account, which is how do the wrestlers themselves make money? Because the story of the promotion and the wrestler's relationship and the way that money is divided between the two, not surprisingly, will continue to be contentious over time. But at this point, if we're talking about, you know, the pure original territory days and then kind of the NWA territory days, you would have wrestlers who would travel and who would have booking fees, and you are paid for a particular appearance in a particular territory, and depending on the, you know, how brightly your star shines, you can command different fees. And so you are truly, and we'll come back to this phrase in a different light later, but you are truly an independent contractor here. Mm-hmm. Being paid on the basis of what you bring to the card.
And so yeah,
that has obviously great meaning for the wrestlers. Where that shows up on the promotion side is this is the beginning of your cost of doing business.
There's, to kind of relate it back to not just sort of ruthless capitalism, but like a particular sense of like an American style capitalism. The wrestler at this time in particular kind of embodies that independent journeyman, mm-hmm. Almost like the Wild West hero, right? He goes from town to town, and does his duty.
Selling
and then
out
moves on.
And...
Yeah, and I mean, that you might think that I'm being like somewhat facetious there, but no, like that, I mean, I do think that's one of the appeals of wrestling and why, again, it arose particularly in the American context, though obviously there are other contexts, is because I think there's this a really close relationship there that, and it's kind of at the heart of the business of it as well, that like, yes, there are local boys and there are local shows, but there's also the sense that like, oh, this person who has traveled around, their fame is also built by the fact that they are traveling around. Mm-hmm. Back then, when we're talking early to middle of the 20th century, people didn't travel as much, mm-hmm. until you had railroad exploding. And even after that, it really wasn't until the highway expansion in the 50s and 60s that like middle class families mm-hmm. would actually travel. So, there's also a sense of worldliness, despite it might seem still kind of local to see a sort of person come in. And again, that ties into the foreign gimmicks we've mm-hmm. talked about and some of those other things.
But then there's also the media angle there as well, which we've mm-hmm. talked about mm-hmm. before. I mean, prior to the advent of television, what were you experiencing in wrestling through? You either went to a live show or you heard it on the radio.
And local.
Local radio, not even national radio. And so that, again, that shapes the perception of when someone comes to town, it's a big deal. And so then a promoter who is trying to, again, put butts in seats has the incentive to go out and pull in that particular talent. But the balance then is, okay, what can I charge for this show versus what's it going to cost me to bring this guy in? And that plays out in interesting ways when you think about kind of the collusion that happens within the NWA, where certain premium talents, your Ric Flairs and your Lou Thezes and these guys, Harley Race. These are guys that if you can work your NWA magic to get them into the territory and fight your local babyface for a match, that can be a huge deal for you. At the same time, if you are a wrestler in that situation, it may not work out in your favor. And stories of wrestlers being blackballed through the NWA are numerous.
Hmm. Yeah, and think about, there's the sort of short-term money-making planning and then the long-term, and some promoters were better at one or the other, yep. And still to this day. And so, think about that, like you were saying, you bring in these big names on a sort of national level to fight amongst and sometimes directly with your local sort of talent that you are also trying to build up to make them seem worthwhile on their own. And so, yes, part of getting, Ric Flair or whomever to kind of come to your show is, people just want to see him. It doesn't even matter who he wrestles. But you also, I think, promoters, a lot of them would be thinking, okay, how can I use this to also, make the guy I'm trying to make a big deal a big deal?
Yeah.
Like, and that's something we still talk about today, right? Like, just by the fact that you get to wrestle John Cena or whoever means you're important. And that was kind of what it was at the time, too. That also gets us into the fun things of, promoters also, like, who gets to decide who wins and things like that. Sometimes those would be literally involved in the deal making with the talent. Like, there would be stipulations for how a match might go. Obviously, that would need to be a talent that has a lot of sort of sway and a lot of clout to sort of make some of those demands or in those negotiations. But, you want to have, a good match that not only gets butts in the seats, but also makes your promotion seems like a big deal, make your talent that you have signed to your specific promotion a big deal. This is where especially you start getting into instances of, promoters who, let's just say, had their children become like the biggest wrestlers. Obviously, the Von Erichs down in Texas are probably some of the most well-known for this, where, you really want your local boys to do well because they're your kids. And
they're probably not going to stab you in the back and take your title to another territory.
Right. And so they ended up, always being put in matches with amazing sort of national talent because that was like, a big deal for the promoter to raise the sort of credibility of his own name and his own kids. Yeah.
So that. I mean, again, all of this conversation, we talk about kind of the dynamics of who you bring in and who you build up in this particular period of time. Again, that ultimately comes back to the idea of how do we put butts in seats? This is still a live ticket medium, by and large. As time goes on, you kind of have two parallel revenue streams that rise up within this sort of pre-Hulkamania period. You have a
America's dark pre-Hulkamania.
Exactly.
Days.
Yeah. Yeah. Before
the before times.
Exactly. We have BH and AH in our year system. You've got kind of the media stream, which manifests as advertising revenue, and then you have merchandise, which begins to become part of the revenue stream, not just for the promotion, but for the wrestler. And the first time I can remember seeing merchandise becoming a core part of a promotion is the AWA. And one of the things that Vern Gagne, the guy who created and ran the AWA and was the top champion there for many, many years, one of the things that he was very, very good at was working with a particular wrestler to create a character and create a marketable character, which turned into catchphrases, which turned into slogans, which turned into t-shirts. There's a hilarious video clip in one of the old WWE archive things about the AWA, where it is the commercial for the AWA line of t-shirts. And what it is quite literally every wrestler on the roster wearing their own t-shirt, walking one after another in front of a camera, looking at the camera for about 2 seconds, flexing, and walking off camera. The next guy's walking on before the last guy's off. It's like, all right, guys, hock your t-shirts.
Fashion show.
Exactly.
That's amazing. And no, and you're absolutely right. And that'll sort of continue on into the future. And again, though, merchandising in particular becomes an interesting point of, again, this relationship between sort of promotion and the wrestler themselves. As we'll get to, sort of merchandising becoming almost the lifeblood of independent or wrestlers sort of making money, you know, per appearance fees only sort of go so much. And those are also going to be, well, I mean, all of it is very precarious, but, you know, think about, you know, what happens if you get injured or what happens if you can't travel or whatever. You know, those are dangerous situations. So you're always looking for something to help stabilize, again, whether you're a promoter or whether you're a performer, your revenue flow.
Well, and there's also the question of if you take a particular card, and this becomes more and more difficult the more cards you run, if you're talking about like WWE World at this point, what's the marginal value to you as a promoter of having one wrestler on the card? Like, if you have John Cena at WrestleMania versus not having John Cena at WrestleMania, how much additional money does John Cena at WrestleMania make you? That's really tough to say. And it's difficult because of that to isolate on a particular show-by-show basis what the value of a given performer is. And that's important because WrestleMania in particular, but shows as a general statement, wrestlers' compensation a lot of time is bonus-driven. Okay, you appear on this pay-per-view, so you get a bigger check. You're in the main event, so you get a bigger check. So on and so forth. But it's tough to do that. Merchandise sales, generally speaking, are not totally objective because you can have good merch and bad merch and things can be placed in particular ways to emphasize particular performers. But it is something a little more tangible where you can point and say, okay, John Cena sold the most t-shirts. He probably is bringing some outsized value to the table here. And so that becomes important not just for the wrestler's revenue stream, but also for communicating back to the promoter the relative importance of a wrestler in the eyes of the fans that they're trying to appeal to, which can have an impact on the wrestler's career.
Yeah, it's a lot like, you know, I've taught about sort of television ratings, right? And like, we, you know, television channels, if we're talking directly live television, you get your money from advertising, and advertising rates are determined by ratings. Ratings are not an objective reality of the amount of people watching. It is a measure, it is measured by Nielsen, a third party. And so like you're creating like, what is our, they essentially create a quantity that's going to be the sort of guiding principle. And that's sort of what that you're setting up here, in that in a lot of ways, merchandising becomes that guiding principle of how do we try to judge an individual performer's worth? But again, that always gets complicated because, like we've said, you know, is it the storytelling? Is it the production values? Is it, you know, the gimmicks? Is it the matches? Like, there's so many things. But most likely, because, you know, if we're talking about business, and this goes back to what you just said, it all comes down to how much am I paying you? How much am I getting money in return from fans or advertisers? So it ends up, yeah, really coming down to this very individual, like, what is your individual worth? Which is, again, so capitalism that it's just like this perfect representation in some ways of that system. And feeds into the system of like, you have to prove your worth over and over again, literally your worth.
And I mean, the canonical example that I think of in terms of like, okay, where can we see that fan feedback and that measure manifesting itself back into story, back into how talent is valued? You think of like Steve Austin when he broke with Austin 316. Austin 316 shirts were everywhere long before Steve Austin was main eventing WrestleManias. That was a way that the institution received feedback that Steve Austin was a moneymaker during a particularly a fallow period for the company. But to your point about kind of the nature of having to prove your worth, there is I think that there is, we are approaching kind of the splitting point in the story of how the wrestling business works, where there was a point in time where you had to prove your worth to every promoter and to every show. And at this point, we kind of split, and we have the independent wrestling scene. We have the kind of world of global bookings where, okay, I'm going to go to Japan and do a 6-week tour or whatever. And you are still in that process. You are proving your worth to an individual booker on the basis of how much attention can I get you? How many butts can I put in seats? What's that going to be? And then at the same time, we have this split into the major media enterprise world where, okay, you have the WWF and it's a big deal. And when WCW becomes a big deal, this is amplified even more, where you get into the world not of, okay, what's my booking fee? What's my contract? And for how many years? And how long is that going to carry me? And what am I worth over that period? And that dynamic is really, really different.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked a little bit about it in our first episode this season about WCW. You know, one of the things that set them apart was their contracts. And it was the idea that not just about how much money can you get, but how does that relate to the other factors like security? You know, a lot of the big names that, you know, were big even in the pre-WWF days, like your Hogan and your Macho Man and Roddy Piper, you know, the reason they all went to WCW in part was because they got long-term contracts, which was not something that the WWF was super big on at the time. And again, this is super interesting. I mean, it's similar to how, you know, sports franchises work, right? Yep. When you're, are you offering someone a short-term contract or a long-term contract? Like, how much an investment do you want to make in them? You're not just thinking about how popular are you now, how popular will you be in the future? If you sort of think someone is going to become popular and you're like getting in at the ground floor, do you try to lock them in at a lower rate for a longer term? You know, like the, all these sort of factors coming in. You know, in general, the WWF model, which I mostly sort of continued on, is for the most part, people had pretty non-long-term contracts. I mean, maybe a couple of years at most. But even that was sort of debatable. And we'll get into some of the labor stuff in a second. But I think you're right to point out that that is a huge just sort of shift in understanding, because it becomes a bit more investment based. It becomes a bit less, okay, what can you do for me right now? But they're also possibly, the promoter is going to consider, what will you continue to do for me? Are you going to be someone who's going to be reliable in the long run? Are you worth investing my time and money in? And also my time in terms of airtime. Yep. Like, I have limited airspace. Are you limited? So, like, just more questions become invested in there, because, as you're saying, suddenly it's not just about ticket sales. Suddenly now it's about TV deals. Now it's merchandising becomes a bigger factor of it. It's about sponsorships, not just for individual wrestlers, but for the entire promotion. And so you're, as the company is making more long-term deals, the company, you know, the promoter is making long-term deals in terms of television deals and advertising deals. It sort of, in a sense, comes down the other way too with the performers themselves. And then, of course, it's just a way to try to, you know, in competition, to lock people up to exclusive deals, which is a big difference, where you would be tied into one place rather than being this journeyman who just kind of, it doesn't really matter. You kind of work on a per appearance fee. It's like, no, that's, no, you gotta be a homer now.
And I think that when you think about how that plays out from the wrestler's perspective, I think there are particular performers who are going to prioritize that stability and security, and there are performers who are going to try to maximize value. So a relatively good comp would be, take Dolph Ziggler on one end, and Dolph is, you know, he has peaked in the WWE. He is not going to get bigger in the WWE than he is, realistically. And then take Cody Rhodes, who is someone who's comparable, I would say, in talent and in tenure and experience and notoriety. Cody has gone independent. I don't know if at the end of the day Cody is going to make more on the indies than Dolph did. He might, depending on what he can command globally. Cody is doing that without the net of the guarantee, and that is a decision that Cody has made. I think the reality of where we are in terms of the wrestling industry structure is, with WWE being the big name in town, your choices are either, okay, I go to WWE and I sign this contract that'll last generally 3 years or whatever, and go that way and maybe not maximize my full value within that period, or I go out onto the indies and maybe find a way to maximize that value, but it's going to be a harder road.
Yeah, I'll say, though, and this is, again, this we're kind of getting into the labor part, which I think we'll have a whole episode on in the future. You know, I think it's become an easier road, comparably, which is why you have people like Cody and others who end up leaving.
Or who never go. Yeah.
Exactly, like the Young Bucks, who command a very powerful presence, and the big deal is now Bullet Club has shirts in Hot Topic. This is not a group. Their most well-known location is New Japan Pro Wrestling. And so because you have internet distribution, because you have a sort of a way that you can build a following without those structures, I mean, that's just kind of fascinating. It's happening in a lot of industries. And wrestling is no exception. I think one of the reasons why it's been it got picked up in wrestling almost a little quicker or a little more assuredly is that there was already that indie scene there. They didn't have to build that from the ground up. Obviously, it got built up a lot more kind of in the last 20 years or so since WWE basically became the only big name business in town. It took a long time to get to where we are now, and you've got ROH, you've got PWG, and all these other, like, I could list on and on, that are, that are, like, fine. They're these sort of mid-level indies. Like, ROH does have a TV deal. It's with Sinclair Broadcasting, so it's going to be local network stuff. But so it's not a national TV deal. Right. And, like, you know, they have pay-per-views and things like that. So, It becomes a very interesting sort of setup there, not just for individual wrestlers, but promotions as well, that promotions can survive in that middle space. You know, TNA has always seemed to struggle because they don't want to be in the middle space.
How is that company still alive?
Or whatever it is now, Anthem or whatever. And it's kind of fascinating. Like, ROH, I remember when ROH was like, I mean, they still are big, but they were like huge at one point. Again, not huge in the sense of like raking in all this money. One of the reasons for that, and now it, maybe it's, unless you, I don't want to jump ahead, but like, is because, you know, WWE now is a multimedia company. They went public in, what is it, 99?
It was late 99, maybe early 2000, but it was right at kind of that Attitude Era peak.
Yeah, it was, because I think it was right before they bought WCW. It was like, it was right around there. But, I mean, this is a, that was a huge deal. You know, before then, WCW was part of a, you know, multimedia giant in Turner, and then eventually Time Warner. WWF was always private. It was the McMahon family. It was a private enterprise.
Business.
And when they, and when you go public, like, that's a huge deal. That is a huge choice for any business. You know, you're ceding certain amounts of control, but you're essentially, when you go public, you're saying it is now, it, we are growing to the point that is beyond sort of any individual can handle. And but you're also making a promise to continued growth.
That's the thing.
That's what needs all this to shift. Because now WWE, they can't just be. And I guess we skipped ahead a little bit, you know, because you have the local. Then of course you have the touring market, and that's that's becomes. It's about putting butts in seats, but then, you know, national touring becomes a big deal. And so it's about putting butts in seats all around the country. And so obviously WWF gets really good at that. And they were always better at that than WCW, who mostly stuck in the South. And so anyway, you've got, like, that was what they mainly did. And so this is where I think we want to get into what you're talking about, these sort of various factors. You've got the touring company, you've got your television deals, got your merchandise. Suddenly, you're not just one thing.
So you make the jump. What I want to talk about is that move to being a public company as WWE. Because to your point, what you are doing there, you fundamentally change the incentive structure of your business. Because now you are accountable to people who are not you. And that affects...
Or your direct customers.
Yeah. And that affects how you operate. It affects how you structure. It affects what your incentives are. Took just a moment. So WWE IPO'd on October 22nd, 1999. So, about 18 years ago. And the stock has not been a great performer. Like if you bought on day one, you bought at $24, and today the stock sits at $28.
That's a pretty high IPO. Good on them.
The market cap of the business today, and for those of you who are not versed in finance, market cap is shares of equity times share price, it's ostensibly a measure of the worth of the business, according to the market, is $2.16 billion as of today, which is interesting when one actually starts digging through the financials. So I spent some time over the weekend with WWE's financial reports, specifically its most recent 10-Q, which it's required by federal law to file once every quarter, and then the most recent 10K, which is the annual filing, disclosing to the world what its financial performance is to inform shareholder and investor decision. Two pieces that I want to highlight here. One, the structure of the business and how it is actually set up now and how it makes money. And then second, the inverse side of that, the cost structure and how that's changed over time, because both of those pieces jumped out at me as being really, really interesting. So let's talk about business structure. So the way WWE breaks this down in their report, our operations are organized around the following principal activities. So there are four core divisions.
I think I know these. Yeah,
so there is the media division. Which includes the network, television, home entertainment, and digital media.
Right.
There is the live events division.
So that's your touring company going around individual shows.
Travel.
I'm going to guess here, I don't have it in front of me, licensing and merchandising?
Consumer products, which encompasses licensing, merchandising, and WWE shop. There are just those three. It is formatted slightly weirdly here.
Because I know they used to put the studio.
No, that's the fourth one. There is a page break.
And that's but that's so.
we'll talk about that in a minute. So rough percentage breakdown. Media division represents about 63% of revenue. So 63% for media. About 20% for live events, about 15% for consumer products, and about 1% for WWE Studios. So not a powerhouse WWE Studios.
But see, what sticks out to me with those numbers, and I want to hear your thoughts as well, but the first thing that jumps out at me is like, you know, it makes sense media is top, but like, that's quite a bit for live, in my opinion. I find it amazing that touring and live performance is still such a huge part of it. I mean, I guess 20% might not sound like a lot, but when you're thinking about how much media, like television, they produce and all that, it is kind of amazing.
So for reference, what that means in revenue numbers, in 2016, live events, revenue from live events was $144 million in 2016. And you're right. It seems like a lot.
Just to think about, like, what other touring companies do you know about? Like, I can tell you I only looked them up when I went to see Disney on Ice, and I was like, Feld Productions? I'm curious about this. And it was like, they also do Monster Jam and like all the stuff that comes to your local arena. You know, there are not a lot of companies that do that. And WWE is sort of fascinating because they are still that company. They are just that company that also is this massive media empire. And that's fascinating to me that they have sort of all both of those. I don't think there's many other companies that you could compare that to.
No.
Where it's that big of a chunk that they ultimately, and that gets us to what makes them in some ways so unique, is that they do those at the same time.
Yeah.
And obviously, there are still house shows that still make money. And like, there's like, because I've read people be like, why do they even do house shows? And I'm like, because they make money.
Yeah. They would not do it if they did not make money.
And it's, yeah. So, but they are like, okay, for them, you know, it costs a lot to do these sort of, to tour the country and put on, you know, multiple shows in multiple cities every day or every week. But, you know, the fact that they are also taping shows to put on television at the same time, it makes it kind of fascinating. Yeah.
So I also, for point of reference, I went back to the 10K report that was filed for fiscal 2012 as well, because it was a different time, and the divisions were organized slightly differently then. At that point, it was live and televised entertainment, consumer products, digital media, and WWE studios. So live and televised entertainment.
Digital was... Right.
Yeah, digital was on
its own. They just threw it all together. Yeah.
Because, as you said, operationally, there is some synergy there. But here's
and what, especially because that's right around...
It's pre-network.
Network, and right. That was when they were working for working to get the network. So that would make sense. Once you launch the network, you kind of make your media its own thing, because like essentially you're not just producing media, you're distributing media. So
that's the key thing here. So back of the envelope, not digging into specific line items, but let's take the network out and group media division and live events together. In 2016, that combined entity under the old structure would have made $398 million. In 2011, that combined structure made $340 million. So some growth. Break them out now. So we set aside live events at $144. Television and home entertainment together would make about $250 million. The network in 2016 made $181 million. The growth in that media division and really the growth of the company in this period in revenue is largely attributable to the network.
And that's why they invested so much. And and it makes sense. I mean, I've written about this elsewhere in a book that's upcoming, hopefully by the end of the year. It's called I have to look it up. It's a chapter in a book I co-wrote with someone about the WWE Network, and just a little plug there. And I'll explain it more once it's actually out. Part of the big argument of that was they were getting into a new line of business, and that was media distribution.
Yep.
That was, and in doing so, they also upset a lot of their pre-existing partnerships with USA, with anyone who provides pay-per-views that suddenly have zero value to them, because if you're constantly telling people don't pay $60 for that pay-per-view, pay $10, you're gonna piss them off. WWE is not lucky, they've earned it in the sense that like they have such a strong partnership with USA and NBC Universal in general that business is still there, because that was in challenge, because it's like, wait, you're making your own network? Why would we air this? But they can't lose that. They can't lose being on USA Network, because that ends up also being a promotion for the WWE Network. It's a crazy thing, because if you look right before the network came out, there was I think it was in 2010, but I could be wrong. There was a relatively recent time when WWE's was basically renegotiating their contracts with USA, and basically the contracts with the channels that they air on. And Vince McMahon's and the company's argument, and a sound one, was essentially no one watches live anymore, but they watch us.
Yep.
Like live TV is dying, but the only ones that still watch live is your like live reality shows and sports and things like that. And he's not wrong. That provided them a lot of value, but I think they ended up overestimating their value because of the hit that the network gave them on that. So it was a big risk.
But if you think about what the trade-off was there and what you were risking, there was the risk to television revenues. Yeah. There was the risk of television revenues, which you're trading off. But again, because the partnership is there, that's a calculated risk. You don't think USA is going to, and Monday Night Raw is not airing live on the network. Yeah. The big revenue line item risk was pay-per-view revenue. And that, I mean, that is a risk. So if we look at 2011, no network, pay-per-view is working. Pay-per-view revenue was $78 million. Guess what pay-per-view revenue was last year? It's higher than that. So I mean, no. Consider global, consider everything. Pay-per-view revenue. Sure. Yeah, revenue in 2016. Oh, yeah, not buys. But revenue was $12.6 million. So year over year, but that's still a 39% drop. From 2011, that's an enormous drop. But net WWE network revenues last year were $180 million. That's a pretty enormous offset.
Yeah. And that change, you know, that business change also obviously ends up changing storytelling and structure of the programming. This is what my co-author Corey Barker wrote about. I don't want to take full credit for it. We've talked about it on this show too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you build towards the special, and that provides either a climax or a sort of a high moment to your narrative, mm-hmm. and then you continue on. You know, part of the thing that they've slowly been transitioning to in the 6 years that they've had the network, or what, however many.
They launched in 2014.
Well, I always forget. Pay-per-view
was the WrestleMania where Daniel Bryan had his
30. Birthday. Yeah, that makes sense. I always forget because they like announced it and then they walked it back. Like, they announced it in like 2011, and then they like when it was still going to be like a premium cable channel. Anywho,
good pivot.
But that changes that, right? Because you have to, you know. One of the things they've done to offset that is offer more pay-per-views. And that was also, I think, part of why we had the recent brand split, just to, like, you know, leverage your sort of assets there. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, how can we make that $10 you're paying a month seem more valuable? And they had to do that after, as we've already talked about, in doing so, you're also like devaluing your pay-per-view when you're literally lowering the price that much. Suddenly it doesn't sound so special. So how do you still make it sound special? And like, this is a criticism that, you know, people are still lobbying, that sometimes pay-per-views don't feel that special. Like, it's like, and sometimes they do, but then other times it's like, that was just like an extra long episode of the television show,
which is already extremely long.
Right. And so I still don't think they've quite figured it out yet. They're still in this like middle space. Mm-hmm. And it's both a business shift and a creative shift, that those things get so closely intertwined. How you're making money is going to dictate how you're telling stories in some ways.
So WWE, you go back to making money. WWE was profitable last year. But I was surprised at how thin the margin was when I started looking at it. So net revenues last year were $729 million. It's a good chunk of revenue. Net income, once you strip away all of the cost side, all of that piece, was only $33.8 million.
Mm.
So net revenues grew at 11% last year. Costs, let me see if I can find total cost here. It's broken out piece by piece, and I'm not going to sit down and calculate all of this right now. But costs grew, and the three big areas where costs spiked were network at 15% year-over-year cost increase. This is amazing to me. WWE Studios, but that's not material, relatively.
Right, still cost money.
Live events, which is attributed mostly to, one, you're hosting more pay-per-views, mm-hmm. and two, you're touring more internationally now, both of which mm-hmm. go to cost. And then this one baffled me. I couldn't figure out a reason why. WWE Shop had a 25% year-over-year spike in cost, which I have no idea why that would be. But net effect of all of this is net income grew 40%, but it only grew to $33.8 million. And if we think about, you know, one way that you value a company conceptually, you think about, okay, you take all future earnings and discount those to the present. If the WWE is earning $33.8 million a year and the market cap is $2.16 billion, I have not sat and built a DCF to like look at that, but there is a little bit of a gap there. Like the PE is pretty big. The PE is like, PE being price to earnings ratio, is 61 right now. That's like, it's not full blown no earnings tech company, but that's a tech company, right, PE. Yeah. Like,
yeah, yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I think parts of this, you know, the network even in general, and I'm going to kind of go bigger here from the sort of details you've laid out, but just the idea of, you know, as we talked before, when you're not in direct competition with a lot of other things, and, you know, WWE in the past has always made very interesting sort of claims of who their competition is, yeah. Like their competition. And it's because of all the ways that they make money. I mean, they're not wrong when they, like, their competition is touring companies. Their competition is what's on television. Their competition is sports, live events. Like, uh-huh. It's all competition. Shelf space in, you know, Toys R Us. It's all things that they're making money from. You know, not a lot of companies have their hands in that many things, at least as directly as WWE does. Uh-huh. Which is what's really fascinating about it. Like, yeah, Disney has touring shows, but they license that stuff out. Like, Disney's not producing that. Like, Marvel Live, yep. Like, that's not Disney kind of working on that. They're just like, okay, yeah, just pay us the rights to use our characters and you can kind of make it and we'll just oversee it and get approval. But WWE is making all this stuff. And that's, to your point, why those costs are so high. And I find that very fascinating. They are extremely protective of their IP. Mm-hmm. And that's a calculated risk. You could make a lot of money licensing this stuff out, mm-hmm. but you risk diluting the product, ruining the stories and the characters you're trying to tell. Mm-hmm. And so they're very cautious. Like, the most sort of, you know, out there stuff we get is like, you know, when they make like the Scooby-Doo WWE crossover, right? Or the video games, right? Or the mobile games, mm-hmm. like that they're handing out to other people. Though now some of those movies, it's in a partnership with WWE Studios.
Yeah, they're still exercising control there.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, it depends, but it's not as hands-on as everything else. Like even the 2K, the video games, like they don't too much of that because they don't know how to make video games. Yeah. They produce a hell of a lot of content, but games they do not make, WWE. So that is all given out to someone else. Obviously they have partnerships there, but like that's why, you know, any wrestler who appears in those games, they have their own deal with the developer, those are individual deals. This was most well articulated in the sort of famous bringing the Ultimate Warrior back because of a video game.
Yep.
Essentially, Ultimate Warrior's first deal with WWE in any capacity in years was actually with the video game company. And they made a deal for his likeness to appear in the game. It had nothing to do with WWE. He didn't have to sign a contract with WWE for that likeness. Or for the name, because he changed his name and got crazy. And then that ended up leading to bringing him back in a lot of weird ways. So there, all that to say is WWE does make those partnerships. And of course, there's a lot on the line when you're considering sort of any sort of franchise licensing and merchandising. But in general, WWE is extremely protective of it, both when it comes to that and when it comes to their performers, which is something I think we would talk about later in that episode when it comes to how performers specifically make money. I think this time we're rightfully sort of focusing on how the promotions and the companies make money. But that becomes really important because, you know, for a lot of these people, their livelihood is in their ability to sort of their likeness, their image. And so how much control, how much legal ownership do you have over that becomes a sort of amazing, fascinating sort of, you know, legal boundary. You know, I always think back to, what was that trivia? I forget which WrestleMania, but it was the WrestleMania where Brock Lesnar fought Kurt Angle. The
19?
I think so, in the main event. And the trivia is that is the first WrestleMania main event, WrestleMania main evented by two people using their real name. And that's fascinating.
That's actually really interesting.
Yeah. Also fascinating because, no, Brock Lesnar is his legal name.
Yeah. amazingly enough, that's the name his mama gave him.
You couldn't, imagine this guy comes in and he looks like him and it's like, my name is Brock Lesnar. And they're like, okay, we're going to call you Hank Fightum or something.
We're going to call you Michael McGillicuddy. I want to do two more quick points on the company finances, and then I do want to talk about talent for a minute because there's some interesting stuff in this about that as well. Right now, I mean, again, I have not sat down and closely analyzed the company or anything like that. It seems expensive relative to its earnings, but I mean, it's the market. You're betting on the future right now, and you are valuing it at that particular premium because you feel confident about the future. And that's the story that Vince McMahon and the executives at WWE have told to the street. They have said, we are going to grow. We are diversifying revenue streams. We have this global opportunity that is unexploited, and we're getting there with the network. And the last few years, it's been really important to tell that story because the company has had to make this transition from being a, for all intents and purposes, a hit-driven business to being a subscription business. And it's navigating that pretty well. They are building up their cash reserves, building up their asset reserves in a good way. The company does not look financially dangerous or over-leveraged or anything like that. It's in a good place. And realistically, a better place than it was a few years ago because of how it's diversified in that way.
And I think a part of that is, again, they've developed more interesting relationships with other wrestling entities, whether it's talent sharing or, you know, having, you know, allowing their superstars to appear at smaller venues or vice versa. To me, that's the future of the company. And I think Triple H knows that since he does a lot of that. To me, eventually, they're going to have to get to the place where the network shows non-WWE programming.
Yeah, that is a switch they have not flipped yet. But
Shocked they haven't. But perhaps because, like you mentioned, that revenue is doing so well from the network. But, you know, think about that. It's like Netflix only having original series. They could do it, but I don't think it would be like that as popular.
Yep.
I think they want to do it. And in a weird way, WWE, I think, is going to go the other direction. They actually started with purely original content. Not, you know, some of it was that they bought, you know, archival footage, but like it's all owned by them.
Well,
that's crazy.
It is. And what you've done in that model then is you have captured your core customer. Like the people who are buying into the WWE product are paying for the network. Growth does not happen at the core. You're not going to take those customers who are paying $9.99 and say, all right, now you're paying
$14. Tell Donald Trump that.
Waka, I'm kidding. Waka, waka.
You can cut that out.
he's a wrestling businessman.
That's true.
But where growth happens is the margins. It's how do you expand to reach those customers that you are not currently reaching? And we say, okay, I don't have in front of me right now exactly what the subscriber count is, but it's probably somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million subscribers. And that's the core subscriber base. So what do you do to get other people to pay that $9.99. And it does ultimately come down to expansion of content. And there is a, if you still anchor yourself to the idea of, hey, we are a wrestling company, so we are going to be wrestling themed, there's a lot of wrestling out there that is not you.
Exactly.
The quickest way to get subscribers in Japan is to strike a deal to distribute New Japan. The quickest way to get subscribers in Mexico is to strike a deal to distribute CMLL or AAA. And that's easier
progress
said than done.
The UK. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They almost got that.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was going to happen.
In the UK in particular. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the route forward. I do want to talk, because you brought it up earlier, about talent contracts, because there is information in the financial statements about the future of talent contracts. And I think it's interesting. So 2017, WWE has about $30.5 million committed to talent. That is what they have committed, which says that, you know, I don't know exactly how that breaks down, but certainly guaranteed contracts.
Yeah.
And then probably some expectation based on individual deals of, okay, you get a percentage of X. We have modeled out this particular percentage, so you're probably going to do this with an outside guarantee.
Exactly, and that's not really going to probably factor in, you know, what they're going to make from merchandise and licensing and things like that, because that's where such a huge bulk of that money is going to come from. It's an indirect, it's not coming from WWE, it's coming via the licensing, and then they get a chunk and WWE gets a chunk.
Yep. So the line item here is service contracts and talent commitments. Mm-hmm. So there's probably some stuff in here that is not pure wrestling talent as well.
Sure.
But $30.5 million. Next year, $24 million. Year after that, $16 million. Year after that, $12 million. Year after that, $7 million. And then about $6 million committed to these contracts in perpetuity. So some of that is going to be wrestlers whose contracts are cycling through. You know, you've heard in the past, standard contract might be a 3-year contract. Some of that is guys who are, their contracts are coming due, or their contracts are structured in a different way. So, of that $30 million, I'd be really interested to know what percent of that is attributed to Brock Lesnar and what percent is attributed to John Cena. And then what continues on from there. So it you do see that fade in that cycle, and next year, who knows what the number will be, but it will not be $24 million. It will be above and beyond $24 million, because guys whose deals have, like, I don't know if Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose, I think they've gone through like their first cycle, like their entry-level contracts have expired and they've signed new deals.
Interesting.
Those guys were getting paid peanuts when they came up.
Yeah. Which is, again, is interesting to think about when you think about, you know, creatively who they push, who becomes champion. Like, there's also that end of it. And like, they can totally do sort of like, think about how creative can influence contract negotiations.
Yep.
And I'm not talking about the fake ones you see on the episodes, right? Where tables get flipped and things like that. That's one of the reasons why, you know, the CM Punk walkout was so amazing, is because those things met in, like, it was maybe the most overlap of like fiction and reality, worked shoot, whatever you want to call it, WWE or any wrestling company has done in a really long time, because it was built on that entire premise. If you're not familiar, CM Punk at the time was about to fight for the title and his contract was coming up, both within the storyline and within real life, though it's unclear when he officially re-signed with the company.
Rumor that they want you to believe is he re-signed the day of the show.
Exactly, which I am skeptical of.
Yeah.
You know, but that's like, was there a handshake deal or whatever? So the idea was he could win the title and then leave the company. And I mean, that's one of the reasons that was so effective, because even all the dirt sheets and everyone's like, as far as we know, his contract is up. And that's happened before. And the idea is always like, well, okay, so that person's not going to win. Like, and it's like, they're maybe not even, you know, they might not even treat them very well, because they're on the way out the door, or you make them look weaker. So they have less of a sort of confidence going into the independent scene alone, and so they'll maybe take, you know, not as much money.
But this is the kind of stuff you don't get in anything but wrestling, which is why it's so fascinating. Like, you had the legend goes, and we don't know how much of this is true, but the legend goes, Punk is going to leave. His last match with the company is going to be a pay-per-view main event in Chicago. The story is going to be built around, will he leave, whatever. And the easy story to tell is that he loses the match and he walks away and it's fine. And, like, no one is ripped off. That story's been told plenty of times. The story that they want you to believe, whether or not it's true, is that Punk cuts his now famous pipe bomb promo. And at that point, he became the hottest thing in wrestling. And that gave him leverage. And the leverage was not necessarily to win the match. You know, winning the match is when he becomes hot. That's the logical decision. The leverage is in how he negotiates a contract.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did on screen in that moment gave him, as the legend goes, flexibility to negotiate a contract that he otherwise would not have earned in that moment.
Right, and to me, this is, and I find it so fascinating that WWE themselves now refer to this as the reality era.
Yeah.
This sort of right after the PG era, they were still technically PG, but slightly getting edgier. And it was things like that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, things that could be so good or so bad, just look at WCW. Like, you can't go too far up your own ass with this stuff. But it is interesting because it's trying to expand their storytelling potential to the sense that it acknowledges that their fans mm-hmm. or either know or can quickly understand the nature of how wrestling contracts actually work.
Mm-hmm.
And like, no other indication would you ever say that. I mean, around the same time, or maybe right after, you had like Big Show's ironclad contract, which is just stupid, right? So they still mess around with that, but like, you know, it requires a certain expectation of awareness and knowledge on the fan base, mm-hmm. Which I think is very interesting.
Maybe
it's something that they don't always want to make clear because that could often undercut the stories that they're trying to tell. In this case, it served to lift up the story they were trying to tell. But I think more often than not, it would undercut it.
Well, because
otherwise everything's going to start.
It works in reverse too, because you are a publicly traded company. You have certain responsibilities about what you can and can't say. The example that I remember is back in like right before the Chris Benoit tragedy. Mm. You had a story where Vince McMahon was killed as a character in WWE. Oh, yeah. His car was blown up, and the announcement was Vince is dead. Now, a week later, it was determined this was in bad taste, and Vince was back on TV. But I remember WWE having to like put out messaging to its shareholders, no, Vince is not dead. This is part of the story. It's fine. Don't worry about it. And that side of it now feeds back. And I guess that leads to the question.
We lost Paul London because of that. That's why Paul London got fired, because of that stupid angle. Did you not?
No.
There was the moment where Vince McMahon, that's how the story goes, that like dramatic shot of Vince like walking backstage past all the wrestlers before he gets in the car and it explodes, which they were trying to do as a sort of like end of Who Shot Mr. Burns. It could have been any one of them.
Who
like
blew up
you can tell shooting it just for the recap videos. But when the camera passes Paul London, he's got the biggest, dopiest grin on his face. He's like, and apparently they were so furious at him that like, I don't know if they immediately fired him, but it pretty much like ended his career right there, because they were like, God, you undercut our most serious, you know, moment where we're killing off the Vince McMahon character with your stupid grin. But it was perfect.
Yeah. That's actually crazy.
Watch.
Yeah.
I don't even have to tell you what Paul London looks like. You'll see it.
You'll know which one he is.
You'll know. And I guess everyone was like, well, obviously Paul London did it.
God,
like,
man.
He was probably aware of what was going on, so he wanted to be like, eh.
I want to see, I want the alternate universe where that story got told.
Yeah.
Where weeks and weeks of WWE programming were spent on who blew up the car, and it ends up, well, you know how it ends up. You know it ends up with Vince coming back and saying, it was me the whole time!
I mean, we're getting off topic here, yeah. But just in general, WWE is not good with mysteries. That is a genre they have not cracked. They try a lot of different genres. We talked comedy just mm-hmm. recently. Mystery, I don't think they've ever done well.
No.
Ever. Whether no. it's running over Stone Cold or mm-hmm. being an anonymous general manager or
Maybe they'll do it now. Maybe the problem before was that they didn't have any compelling detective characters, and now they have Breezango.
Oh, if only.
Yeah, that is losing the plot a little bit from our business conversation, but it does get to the point of like this is a damn circus in so many ways. There is, just as there is an interplay between fiction and reality in the presentation of WWE programming, there is also an interplay between the fiction that is being presented and the business that is actually being run, and the way that the two intersect, I can't think of a parallel in sport, in media, in anything else. It's a fascinating story, and I think that there is and maybe you and your co-author have started to crack this nut with the network book that you have been writing. But I think that there is...
It's a chapter in another book,
fair enough.
Just to be clear. We're not that awesome
fair enough.
Yet.
But I think that there is a fascinating case study to be done here. And it would not shock me if, you know, HBS has a business school case study on the decision mm-hmm. to launch the WWE Network in the not-too-distant future. And the history of how this business has evolved to make money... and to go from putting butts in seats to being one of the more interesting and well-diversified media companies I can think of.
Yeah, and I mean, to kind of help bring it full circle, I'll also tie it in with a little extra credit. You might know this if you're listening to this podcast, but even if you don't, you know, to talk about wrestling and then WWE as the sort of primary feature of, like, American capitalism... Mm-hmm. Former CEO Linda McMahon is now the administrator, the head of the Small Business Administration, mm-hmm. under the president. And I still remember, so there's your little trivia factoid, but I still remember watching the Senate hearings or the confirmation hearings for that post. And she was one of the least, you know, controversial choices. Cause it's like, okay, yeah, this is where you have business experience.
Family business at a scale.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like, that makes perfect sense. Like, I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. And like, it was a very fun hearing because it was like one of the few that was not heavily political.
The wrestling executive being named to the government post was not the circus.
Yeah. Exactly. But like, you would have like even the Democrats just asking like silly questions about like what's The Rock like in person, and but I think that speaks to it a little bit, because there's the individual stories, like I had mentioned, about how it sort of represents the success of the common man, but then there's this sort of macro story of like the success of an American sort of business or an American way of doing business. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, WWE also gets kind of, you know, held up in that regard, outside wrestling interests, that, you know, there are people who don't know anything about wrestling as a sort of all the ways we've talked about it on this podcast, but can see it just as the business entity that it is.
Yeah.
So like you had said, just in that business sense, there's a whole other sort of way of looking at it and approaching it. And we just kind of scratched the surface here.
Oh, this is a 102 course. When they come back to us to do their thesis, we'll go deeper into it. What's your battery at right now?
Good question. 6%.
Okay, let's move into homework assignments very quickly. Sure. Why don't you go first?
We were doing all right. Yeah. I don't know. This was a tough one. This doesn't directly have to do with what we were talking about, but I don't think I've recommended this yet. And it makes me kind of think about it a little bit. And correct me if we have measures, but the South Park episode WTF.
No, we haven't. That's a great episode.
I believe it's in season 10. I was looking it up before. Season 10, episode 6, I want to say. But the episode name is WTF. And the kids on South Park, in classic fashion, get really into something. They get into wrestling. And they start putting on their own shows. And they draw the attention of Vince McMahon. Mm-hmm. Most of the humor comes from the sort of fact that it is a soap opera for men, which is not the most, unique or interesting take, but they do it so well, as South Park does. Also in the sense that that ends up not really, it almost starts as the joke, but then that's not the joke. Because the sort of the rednecks or whatever show up to watch, but then they're also drinking their wine, and you've got this sort of Greek theater set up for their wrestling shows. And when we say their wrestling shows, they're literally just talking. They never actually fight.
Yeah.
They're just like, she cheated on me with you. That's because it's my baby. and Vince McMahon is watching with like opera glasses up in the corner. So I really like it. I think it does a nice job of sort of playing with the high and low culture. That in some ways I think you could read that episode as, in a lot of ways, I think it glorifies wrestling, or at least in the sense that it doesn't treat it as a joke. It makes jokes about it. But ultimately, I think the message is like, why would we think this is dumber than opera or vice versa? Like, because it's who watches it or something like that, right? Like, mm-hmm. What's to say you can't have rednecks at a Greek theater enjoying it? It's very silly and very funny. I think I thought about it just because I guess the part of the plot is that they think Vince McMahon might buy them because they're getting very popular. So I thought of that when I was like, yeah, there's Vince McMahon. There's a cartoon version of Vince McMahon doing business. So there we go. South Park WTF is the name of the episode.
That is fantastic. I have to confess, I didn't do my homework this time around. I'm gonna pull a recommendation out of thin air. Let's see. We'll shake up the crystal ball. I am going to recommend some actual wrestling. I am going to recommend some actual wrestling from what I believe is my favorite year of wrestling, which is the year 2000, when WWE. It was still the Attitude Era, but it was the Attitude Era where the edges had been sanded off and the talent roster.
Are you talking about Edge?
Yep. For the benefit of those with. You should. You really should.
There was only one Edge. It was a fake Edge.
Oh God! You have Edge, and then you have fake Razor. That year, 2000, fantastic year in wrestling, and a little bit of matchwork, not really related to the business side of it. Fully Loaded 2000, a last man standing match between Chris Jericho and Triple H. And the gimmick of this particular card, it was three younger up-and-coming wrestlers, and at the time it was Kurt Angle, Chris Jericho, and Chris Benoit, facing off against three established main event wrestlers, The Undertaker, Triple H, and The Rock, in sort of a triple main event setup. And the Jericho-Triple H match, I remember there being some consternation at the time by the fact that Triple H, who was the main eventer, won the match, and it's Triple H holding down a talent and blah blah blah. Same thing that you always hear, with some validity. Anyway, the match itself is a fantastic piece of storytelling and is one of those instances of, and we talk about this as something that a really good match can accomplish. A match where both men came out of it looking better than they went into it doing. No real deep thematic tie to our show today, other than saying that Triple H is now an executive at mm-hmm. WWE in a very real capacity. But
he understands the business.
He does. but an example of wrestling as a pure form and allowing yourself. I remember the most last time I watched the match was maybe a year ago. But still getting swept up in it. It's just a really, really exceptional piece of wrestling storytelling. And sometimes, we talk about go watch this media tie-in, go read this, blah, blah. Sometimes it's good to just go watch wrestling. And this is some good wrestling to go watch.
And if I recall, it's another good example too of you don't need the whole, there's no deep story that you need. No. It's just
these two
you
guys could
watch, you watch the match, they want to win.
Yep.
You can tell a story. You don't all the other stuff is great and we love it, but you don't need if you are only the best of the best wrestlers can tell a story with almost no context. And I definitely think both of them can do that. I would say Jericho's a little bit better at the no context.
Yep.
Triple H works really well when he has something to build off of. But here he's kind of building off of Jericho's relatively youthful,
And the rivalry at this point was Jericho and Triple H's wife, Stephanie.
Yeah.
That's an interesting but kind of as your example, WTF was about the parts of wrestling that are not wrestling, and this is about the part of wrestling that is pure wrestling. Yeah.
There you go. So you'll get a very well-rounded, well-rounded wrestling diet for you heading forward. All right, I think that about wraps us up.
I think
up
it about wraps your battery life.
I guess I call this meeting adjourned. This conference call. Yeah. I don't know.
If this was a conference call, we would have spent the first 10 minutes saying, "Can you guys hear me? Is someone on mute? If you're not talking, could you please go on mute?"
But it is, again, that is relevant if you've ever, because they, WWE has to do conference calls. So, talk about exciting commentary about wrestling. Oh, boy.
God. Can you imagine you imagine being on a conference call with Vince McMahon?
I will say this though. I think I'm pretty pleased with our ability to do what I hope was an enjoyable and informative show about something that could have been very dry.
Yeah, this is not the sexiest aspect of wrestling, but again, if we're going for understanding, I think it is very important to understand how the business works.
Absolutely, and I encourage anyone like you did, Stefan, and I've done in the past. Look up those reports. They're actually not that hard to read once you get into it. The nitty-gritty stuff, it's ridiculous, but the summaries are pretty straightforward, and it's fascinating to see those breakdowns, and I was really, really keen on hearing those. So take a look for yourself. Let us know if you find anything interesting in those reports.
Your homework is to audit.
That's right. That is the greatest. So this week we are auditing the wrestling.
We expect you to perform a full analysis of this statement and come back next week with a buy, sell, or hold recommendation. That is actual homework that I had to do in business school, by the way.
There you go. I want the Jim Cramer Mad Money recommendation. No, I want you to push a button and it says, should I body slam?
Yep.
Should I jump off the top rope? Should I? It's I don't know what any of these mean. Which one means buy? Anyway, if you want to teach us how to end shows more quickly,
yes,
you can find us online. I'm available on Twitter at dzolides, dzolides.
And I am on Twitter at Stefan Claypool. That's stefanclaypool. You can also find us at stoutbot.com, and you can make contributions to the show at patreon.com/stoutbot. And please do, so we can keep doing these fun shows.
Yeah, and at 1% battery life, that'll sign off. I've been Drew Zolides.
This has been Stefan Claypool. Drew, go plug your computer.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.